What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Beth Warren, author of Secrets of a Kosher Girl, a 21-day nourishing plan to lose weight and feel great, even if you're not Jewish. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Too Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, and our Shinshinim Chen Denachi and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Temperatures have soared here in southern Arizona, where I live, climbing well over 105 degrees in advance of summer's official beginning this week, June 20th. It's hot here, no fooling. And that means the best thing to do during the long, hot part of the day is to stay inside in air conditioning, which makes it a great time of year to do a little Jewish studying. Now, I realize Judaic learning might not be the first thing you think of when you hear the word summer, but the truth is that this is a wonderful time of opportunity to do some intellectual growing. While the American Jewish community is the most educated Jewish population in all of our people's long history, that's only true when we talk about general secular education. Our American Jewish community's knowledge of Jewish subjects is sadly pretty deficient, and there is no time to remedy that like the summer. I've been thinking about the way we adult Jews so often neglect Jewish learning in the course of our lives. We usually know a great deal about politics and the arts, about music and sports, about travel, dining, and other aspects of contemporary life we deem essential for any civilized person. But Jews today usually don't know much at all about the extraordinary storehouse of wisdom, spirituality, ethics, and understanding that the Jewish people has acquired over the past 3 millennia or so. Over the next few weeks, we'll look at some of the amazing texts of Jewish tradition that are surprisingly accessible to adult learners today, in an era when all knowledge is literally at our fingertips. But to get us started in this season of summer, I suggest taking a few minutes each day to read a chapter or so of the primary Jewish text, the Torah, the first 5 books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. There are a number of good English translations available online, or you can just purchase the JPS Tanakh, the most consistently reliable translation, either in hard copy or Kindle format. And you can study Torah starting anywhere in the book. I suggest beginning with the book of Deuteronomy, which is the text we'll be reading in synagogues most of this summer. Well, every summer. It's a remarkable literary work all by itself, Deuteronomy, Devarim, and I think if you take 10 minutes a day to read a chapter of Torah, you'll find yourself moved and curious and Jewishly stirred in new and different and positive ways. And you can do all of this in the air-conditioned comfort of your very own home. To play us in this morning on this theme of Jewish learning, here's a cool take on Elu Devarim, the passage in the Talmud that concludes, "Of all the commandments, studying Torah is equal to them all." This one is composed by Ben Steinberg.
Thank you. Talmud Torah.
Elu
That was Elu Devarim, sung by cantors Arik Luck and Roz Barak. Our guest this morning, Beth Warren, is a nutritionist and specialist in healthy eating, and she believes that you can do it successfully by keeping kosher. Find out how and return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. Beth Warren has a new book out, Secrets of a Kosher Girl, a 21-day nourishing plan to lose weight and feel great even if you are not Jewish. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about how this evolved. When people think of diets, the first thing they think about is losing weight. The second thing they think about is not how do I do that in a kosher way.
Right. Well, what I was aiming to do here with the book is to really come up with a plan that could kind of reset, refocus, and refresh people's body and minds so that they learn enough about themselves to maintain whatever results they aim to get by following. And a lot of times, because they will be structured and they'll be told exactly what to do in the book and given a lot of recipes and meal plan ideas to follow, it will result in weight loss if someone has to lose weight. So that's the beauty of the plan, is that we're focusing on the mind and body, yet you're getting the result of weight loss, but something that's maintainable as well.
You know, the concept of dieting is in some ways a little bit anathema to a Jewish understanding of health. It's a more holistic approach. That seems to fit with the way people really think about eating today, doesn't it?
Yeah, so it happens to be, well, first, it takes years in the making to actually publish the actual book.
Of course.
So these days, right, because these days the trend in the world is more about intuitive and mindful eating, which is fabulous, and it goes very much along with what's behind the strategy of Secrets of a Kosher Girl. So the whole kosher aspect of this is more about the fact of what we're supposed to learn about food, how we eat, our behaviors, and what we're thinking about while eating because we are kosher. So it's not so much about the fact of what you can and cannot eat, and that's why this could be for people who aren't even Jewish, but it's even easier for people who are. It's more about the fact of what do you learn behind the lifestyle of keeping kosher, or what are we supposed to have learned but are ignoring about the lifestyle of keeping kosher. And that's where a lot of the mindfulness comes in from, is because technically speaking, we have the brachot, or blessings, before we eat, where we're supposed to stop and look at what we're having and appreciate it a minute. Then during it, there's even different blessings on the variety of foods that you're eating. So it's even more so that you're supposed to be paying attention. And then you have after the fact, there's another blessing after that you're supposed to sit there a minute and allow your food to digest a second and focus on what you just did. And that was, you know, a major part of the fact of how you have to, like, be doing more than just putting food in your mouth. You have to be understanding that there's an act here, or there's something more to eating than just putting food in your mouth.
We will explore that and maybe the whole concept of sacred eating at the heart of Kashrut, but also how it fits with your approach to a healthier lifestyle. When we come back with Beth Warren in a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, twojewishradio.com, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Amir.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
There is a big production coming here. Let's talk a little bit about what Israeli scouts are, the Tzofim, and what this scout caravan is.
Okay, so the Israeli Scouts is a youth movement in Israel. I believe about 80,000 kids. They're from third grade all the way to 12th grade and all over the country. And basically, it runs by the youth itself. So obviously, there are chaperones and adults, you know, supervising. But they really are mentoring them to lead. The high school kids are the ones who are running the show. Now, what we are lucky to have this coming Monday is the Israeli Scouts Caravan, which basically there's like auditions in Israel to at least two groups that come to the States, one for the East Coast, one for the West Coast. They dance, they sing, both in English and in Hebrew. And they come here every year. And they come for a long time because they come, you know, to travel and to perform in different communities, not necessarily just Jewish communities, but synagogue, churches, and summer camps, and general community as well.
They're really ambassadors for Israel in the most positive way. Incredibly talented and energetic and positive young people. I've met them a number of times, had them in my synagogue. And it's a great show, too. Where is it? When is it? What does it cost?
So it is tomorrow, Monday the 18th, 7 p.m. at the JCC. And it's open to all and it's free of charge.
Free of charge, my kid.
Yeah, we would love to see everyone there.
I have to say, having hosted it and have these kids, I mean, they make you feel better about yourself just being around them. Their energy is so amazing. And they're very talented performers. If you think that you like watching, you know, absolute amateurs up on stage somewhere, that is not what these kids are. They're young, but they're very, very good.
They're talented and they work really hard.
When they're here, in addition to the performing that they do, what else do you guys involve them in?
So basically, they're here for 3 nights. Okay, so they arrive on Sunday to prepare, and they go to host families. We at the Weintraub Israel Center strongly believe that building a bridge is not sending them to a hotel.
Right.
So any delegation that comes from Israel, and we're blessed to have more than one a year, as you know. We just had the Zuza, the Israeli dancers.
Right.
So yeah. So
for the
so
70th anniversary, right?
Correct. So the Israeli caravan group is actually 12 of them. So they're going to 6 different homes. You know, stay by twos is Noach Ark, and
and 2 by 2.
Correct. So basically 3 nights, and then 2 nights with the host families, and 1 night with American Scouts.
Yeah, hanging out with which is a wonderful program. And by the way, there's a Jewish troupe here, and I know that they're interacting with them as well. It's a wonderful connection. So that's tomorrow night, Monday, June 18th, 7 p.m. at the JCC. It's free to hear and see and probably meet these wonderful Israeli scouts.
And I would love to meet in person everyone that comes. I mean, it's a great opportunity. You heard my voice. Now see my face.
Now
shake
you can
my
see
hand.
And yes. They can see if you have hair, if you don't have hair.
Yes, that's a mystery.
Thanks so much, Amir. We'll talk
next
week.
Thank you, Rabbi.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, you travel more than any person I know. That could make you a wandering Jew, I suppose. One of the really fascinating things for me has always been the way that Jews have traveled and found a way wherever they travel to connect with Jewish communities and have kind of an instant in, even if they don't have the local language or know the local customs. But this is not exactly a new trend, is it?
No, hardly. I mean, you make me think back to my late teens when I traveled across Asia. And I was in fairly obscure places in southern Iran, Afghanistan, whatever. But I could always find a synagogue or a rabbi or a Jewish family to invite me for Friday night dinner. And there was always a sense in which you felt at home. You had a common language, be it French or Hebrew or English, but you found a way to communicate with people without knowing the local language. And you felt like part of the worldwide Jewish community, the Am Yisrael. But of course, your question really goes back to the Middle Ages, where even before the Crusades, but especially after, there were these pretty well-established trading routes that extended all the way from southwestern Europe to China. And the best-known one, of course, is the Silk Route, described not only by Marco Polo, but also a famous Jewish travel writer, Benjamin Mitudela, who was from Spain, the city of Tudela. And nobody knows how much of what either of these guys wrote was factual or embellished or in part enhanced by their imaginations. But there are definite physical records of Jewish communities established in very unexpected places, scattered all across Central Asia and China. We were talking earlier off mic about Xi'an, which is known for the Terracotta Warriors,
right?
And which for a brief period had nonstop flights from the U.S. on United Airlines. And what most people don't know is that the old city of Xi'an was a major stop on the Silk Route. And so the old bazaar looks very much like any bazaar in the Middle East. It was largely a Muslim city, where there was a Jewish community of traders and there was a synagogue and all that, because they flourished along this route. Now, one of the questions is why?
Right.
Why did Jews go to such far-flung places? And another question is how? How was it safe to travel? How did they change money? There were obviously no ATMs in those days.
Not quite.
You couldn't send an email to ask about somebody's credit rating. So how did all that work? And that's something I think we can talk about in some detail in our next session.
Great, great thing to do, especially in this season of travel. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Shin Shinim, our representatives of Israel here in America, Chen Denachi and Tamir Shakuri. Boker Tov. They're here representing the Weintraub Israel Center. So we talked last time about the length of time that you'll serve in the military when you go back to Israel, and not very long. And then the way that it works in Israel is you go in the military, and unless you sign up for to become an officer or a pilot or certain elite units, you serve your time 2 years and 4 months approximately for women, 2 years and 8 months for guys now. And then you go on your big trip around the world, or to South America or to India or Thailand or wherever it is, come back and go to university. Most Americans know something about how it works to apply to American universities now, which is enormously elaborate process, lots of essays. You guys have lived with people who've gone through that process. Also, I should mention, incredibly expensive to go to a private college. Even public colleges, if they're not in your state, are very expensive. Very different in Israel. Tell us a little bit about that process.
So a lot of people here ask me, like the first thing they ask me is, where are you going to go to college? And I'm like, I don't even think about that. That's so far away from me right now. I'm not even close to starting the army. So here, college feels really real because we both have host siblings that are now applying to colleges and are now accepted to colleges also. And the application process is really long. In Israel, it's a little bit different because there are less universities to apply to, because in America, people don't look at like the states as something that would prevent them from going to different places, at least the people I know. So you have so many options. And in Israel, the options are a little more limited. Also, it depends on what you want to learn. And I think that for now, my plan is to become an architect and study in the Technion, but it might change till I finish the army and finish my post-army trip.
That's a great goal. Technion is a fantastic university, particularly for technical skills. Chen, you're not going to the Technion.
I am not going to the Technion, Rabbi. Well, I would much, much, much rather be in the University of Tel Aviv, favorite city of all times. And
the beach, of course.
Of course. And I really hope to get into medical school. Also, something different is that here you have like 4 years of like just general college kind of, and you can do like pre-med. And in Israel, like you go in to exactly what you're studying. Like you don't have anything like that could surprise you. Like most people don't change their majors as often as they do here. Also, because I feel like you start the process a lot later in life, so you know more what you want to do. And then also, there's this thing where like here, a college and a university are basically the same, and in Israel, it's very different. Because university is like public, so it's like sponsored by the government. It's still very expensive, but it's not half as expensive as here.
What's very expensive in Israel for a public university?
Like,
do you guys know?
Well, I don't want to get it wrong.
Yeah,
but
sure.
I feel like it's much less expensive than here for sure.
I think it's similar to or less than a public university if you're a resident of the state. In America.
But then college, unlike here, college is a whole different thing. So we have university, which is the public sponsored one, which actually has like a higher reputation, like a better reputation. And then college is the private one where like a lot of people just pay a lot of money and then they get in. So it's kind of like you bought your degree. So a lot of people don't see it like as prestigious.
Although I should say there are now some really good private institutions like the one in Tel Aviv, the
Michal Al-Minal.
Yeah.
Still not as like...
But not as prestigious as Hebrew University in Jerusalem,
yeah,
or the
exactly.
Technion or even Tel Aviv University, right?
Yeah.
Bar-Ilan.
Yeah.
So that's the plan.
That is the plan, hopefully.
I should also note that means that when Israelis get into college, they're already 22, 23 years old. And it's
exactly.
A different approach than an 18-year-old.
It is. We don't party as much.
Too old. Thanks so much, guys. We'll
Thank
talk next
you.
Week. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. One day in the woods, a Jewish hiker suddenly sees a giant grizzly bear. The bear sees him, too, and starts to chase him. The terrified hiker stays ahead for a little while, but the bear is faster and it corners him. Giving up all hope, knowing he's about to be eaten, the hiker begins to chant the Shema, the last words a Jew says before death. Shema Yisrael. To his shock, the grizzly bear stops in front of him. And then the bear begins to recite Hebrew. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam. Blessed are you, God, ruler of the world. The man is overjoyed. What are the odds that this hiker would be chased by a Jewish bear? God is gracious. How lucky he is. He's going to live. And then the hiker hears the bear's final words. Hamotzi lechem min haaretz. Thank you, God, who brings us food to eat. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week in the book of Numbers, we read the odd ritualistic Torah portion of Chukat, the rites of the red heifer. In order to achieve true ritual purity, ancient Jews were required to find a completely unblemished young red female cow, slaughter it, burn it to ash, and mix those ashes with water to create a liquid of purification in which to wash away ritual impurity. While many elements in the sacrificial code of our ancestors seem odd or alien, this might be the very strangest ritual of all. It turns out that the red heifer, the Parah Adumah, makes the one who washes in its ash water pure, but it makes everybody else who comes into contact with it impure ritually. The mystery is pretty complete. Commentators have struggled with its meaning ever since the time the Torah was given. Just what is it that makes a red heifer the right animal to bring purity to the people? And why does it make you pure if you use it properly, but makes you impure when you are properly preparing it? The classic answer to the first question is that God ordains the use of a red heifer as a symbolic reversal of the episode of the golden calf. Since the people sinned by praying to an idol of a calf, the very real slaughter and burning of an actual cow and the use of his ashes might well atone for that transgression. But why should the process of making something that cleanses us ritually make us unclean? Perhaps the answer, too, is symbolic. The process of bringing holiness into our world is never easy. Working in the field of holiness creation won't be simple. When you toil in the vineyards of the Lord, there's a tendency for the muck that always exists in the world to attach itself to you. We seek to bring purity in the lives of others, but we stand a good chance of exchanging some of our own innate sanctity for a bit of the grime that stubbornly persists in nearly everyone's existence. This complex reversal of holiness in a sacred cow, like the red heifer, symbolizes the way in which we can only bring sanctity and purity at a price. When we acknowledge that price, accept it, learn to cleanse ourselves ritually, perhaps psychically too afterwards, we replenish our ability to help and heal others. This can be true for anyone engaged in ritual healing, if you will, but also for those engaged in assisting the damaged and broken among us to find wholeness in any field of endeavor. It is just as true for psychologists, social workers, physicians, nurses, for counselors and teachers, indeed for anyone occupied with working to help heal the world. First, we work to heal. Then we must also work to heal ourselves so that we can continue to help others. When we return on To Jewish, Beth Warren will explain how to lose weight, feel better, look better, and be healthier, all while keeping kosher. She has a new book out on it. Find out about it when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The Band's Visit, the charming musical based on an Israeli film about an Egyptian band stranded in a hardscrabble Negev town, won the 2018 Tony Award last week for Best Musical, and it nearly swept the awards, winning 10 Tonys overall.
Waiting, what's new here? You're waiting, I'm waiting, 'cause that's what we do here, same as we do every day for something I don't know. To happen, you know, just something different to happen. Just waiting for something to change, just a change.
Sometimes it feels like we're moving in a circle, around and around with the same scenery going by, but no one's complaining. We're experts at waiting.
The Band's Visit dominated the categories it was nominated for during the 72nd annual Tony Awards ceremony held at Radio City Music Hall last Sunday. Ariel Stachel, California-born son of an Israeli Yemenite father and an Ashkenazi mother from New York, won the award for Best Featured Actor in the musical for his performance as a romantic Egyptian trumpeter. Tony Shalhoub of Monk fame won for Best Actor in a Musical, and Katrina Lenk won for Best Actress in a Musical for their roles as the leader of the band and the Israeli cafe owner who takes him in. The band's visit won awards for Best Book by Itamar Moses, Best Direction of a Musical, Best Original Score by David Yazbek, Best Lighting Design, Best Orchestration, and Best Sound Design, really everything. The band's visit is a play based on the 2007 award-winning Israeli movie directed by Aaron Kolarin. In her acceptance speech, Katrina Lenk paid tribute to the late fantastic Israeli actress Ronit Elkabetz, who originated her role in the film. In his acceptance speech, Stachel acknowledged his parents, who were in the audience, saying the musical led him to embrace again an identity he had avoided. Stachel then thanked producer Oren Wolf for telling a small story about Arabs and Israelis getting along at a time where we need that more than ever. Amen. In other Tony news, that is Jewish Tony news, Angels in America playwright Tony Kushner's very Jewish 1993 epic about the AIDS epidemic won the award for Best Revival of a Play for the 2018 version starring Andrew Garfield. And Lindsay Mendez won for Best Performance by an Actress in a Featured Role in a Musical for the revival of Carousel. Mendez, whose father is Mexican-American, identifies herself as a Mexican-Jewish girl. And, of course, a couple of weeks ago, we had the pleasure of featuring Itai Benson, a star of the band's visit, right here on Too Jewish. You can always replay that episode, and mazel tov to the great Tony Sweep of a band's visit.
Here I am, here I am, and the light is dying. Where are you? Where are you? Will you answer?
A remarkable story from Israel, an exact replica of a Dutch synagogue blown up by the Nazis late in World War II, was inaugurated last week. Jews of Dutch ancestry celebrated the inauguration at Mavoch Haron, a town near Modin and Latrun, about 25 minutes west of Jerusalem. The town's Chaste Enosh synagogue is an exact copy of the Terborg synagogue destroyed by the Germans in 1945 near the city of Arnhem in the Netherlands. The building project was a result of an effort by descendants of Jews from Arnhem. Frank Levy, who was born in Arnhem and immigrated to Israel, said it was a dream come true to see the new synagogue, a classic example of Moorish revival architecture, pink and white stones interlaced. It is one of only a handful of such synagogues built in Israel in that style. The Germans tried to make this impossible, said Levy, about the Nazi occupation forces, who along with local collaborators murdered 75% of Dutch Jewry. But here we are. Also in attendance at Mavoch Haron was Pesach Pop, a nephew of Johan Cruyff, the legendary Dutch soccer player and World Cup star. A descendant of Jews who lived in the Arnhem area, he found the building's blueprints while investigating his own family's history. The Arnhem region's Holocaust victims are commemorated on a wall of the new synagogue. Nothing but the Torah scrolls remain from the original Terborg synagogue. For this dedication ceremony, these were brought to the new synagogue in Israel in a horse-drawn cart, in accordance with the custom of Jews from Arnhem, just as these same Torah scrolls had been brought into the original synagogue in Terborg in the Netherlands. Levy brought them from Holland to Israel in the 1980s. They now have a new home in a beautiful old new synagogue.
Der Ballgame zum Eulen lo mir doch gehen. Kauf mir den Nistloch und Cracker Jack. Die lief kein Mulf und dort nicht weg. Jetzt ein Mut, 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 die Ballspieler. Es passt nicht als ein Verspiel. La
als je zegt, ze weet, de ijs lijkt ze nooit bij haar baseballspiel.
And from our slightly ridiculous sports trivia department, June 8th was the most productive home run day for Jewish hitters in Major League Baseball history. Five members of the tribe combined for six home runs last Friday to help their respective teams to victory. Here's the scorecard. Ryan Braun hit two home runs, driving in five to lead the Milwaukee Brewers to a 12-4 win over the Philadelphia Phillies, who have a Jewish manager, by the way, Gabe Kapler. Kevin Pillar, the Toronto Blues' outstanding center fielder, known more for his fielding than his skills at the plate, hit his sixth homer of the year, third in seven games, in a win over the Baltimore Orioles. Even more trivially, Danny Valencia, the third baseman for the Orioles that night, was the only Jewish position player in action not to hit one out that day. Alex Bregman hit his eighth home run, a solo, in the Houston Astros' win over the Texas Rangers. The Astros selected his younger brother AJ in the recent MLB draft, so it's conceivable they could become the first set of Jewish brothers to play on the same team since Norm and Larry Sherry were members of the Los Angeles Dodgers and world champions from 1959 to 1962. And Ian Kinsler's seventh homer gave the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim the two-run cushion they needed in their win over the Minnesota Twins. He hit his eighth home run and fifth in June. The next day, Kinsler, of course, is from Tucson, Arizona. Nice Jewish guy and a past guest of Too Jewish. And finally, Jock Peterson launched lucky number seven, his sixth homer in the month of June when the Dodgers beat the Braves that day. Peterson gained national distinction last fall when he set a new record for homers by a Jewish guy in a World Series. He connected three times against the Astros. That surpassed Detroit Tigers Hall of Famer Hank Greenberg, who had two in 1934 against the Cardinals. All told, Braun, Pillar, Bregman, Kinsler, and Peterson accounted for 29% of their team's RBIs on Friday, Erev Shabbat. I guess if you're going to break Shabbos, you might as well hit a Major League home run. To give this a little Jewish historical home run perspective, back in 2002 on May 23rd, Sean Green of the Dodgers hit four home runs all by himself, along with a double and a single, in a 16-3 win over the Brewers. Only 18 hitters in baseball history have ever hit four homers in a game. It's harder to do than pitching a perfect game. Sean Green also set a single-game record that day that still stands, 19 total bases. And finally, back on August 20th, 1938, Maury Arnovich and Phil Weintraub of the Philadelphia Phillies hit home runs in an 8-7 win over the New York Giants. Harry Danning, the Giants catcher, also hit one out. That is the only time three Jewish Major League players have ever homered in the same game. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Beth Warren is the author of Secrets of a Kosher Girl. She also has Beth Warren Nutrition and is a nationally registered nutritionist. The book explores how to not only lose weight, but more importantly, do it in a way that creates a kind of new concept of food. Beth, you know, in Judaism, we take this basic act, eating, which everybody does, every creature on earth consumes, and try to turn it into something holy by, as you mentioned earlier in the show, brachot, blessings before, blessings after, washing our hands before this whole ritual. How does that affect, you know, obviously you can be kosher and follow all of the halachic requirements of keeping kosher and still not be in such great shape. How do you integrate that in a nutritionally oriented and focused way in your work?
That's a great question, because first of all, everything you just mentioned should at least plant the seed in people's minds of the fact that eating is much more involved than it just being about what's on my plate here. There's all these acts around and involved with eating that we have to wake up and say that maybe there's a lot more to it than this, and I should think about it a bit more, or why else would there be such a stress or an emphasis on it, right? So that's first of all. Another thing I bring up in the book is from a different aspect of just being, you know, the Jewish lifestyle and what we learn throughout teachings, is the fact of ushmartem et nafshechem, or, you know, guard your souls. And this is a common theme throughout the book of the fact that we have to do what we can to guard our souls or our neshama. One of those things is keeping healthy and eating well. It should be something that's just as a priority as it is about keeping kosher, period. Like you said, people may keep kosher, but then they're not doing it to be healthy. Well, then you could take it to mean a different angle. Well, we are also fulfilling the commandment to safeguard our souls, and that has to do with being healthy. So there's so many aspects of our lifestyle that could translate into helping us set the intention to be more healthier with it. And it's exactly my point in the introduction. I talk about why people may not be successful with their health or their weight goals. And I say, well, it's interesting because maybe it's the fact that you're focusing on the physical. Maybe it's the fact that you're focusing on how you look and you're not focusing on what you are, like your being, and why it's important for inside, you know? And you were talking about, we were talking about trends in the world. It's actually that body positive vibe is perfect for totally in line with this book, because it is more about internal feelings and how you feel because you're eating healthy or eating well. And that's really ultimately the reason why we keep kosher, is not about the physical. It's about the spiritual or your neshama, your souls, and safeguarding that. So it's really, you know, the world's catching on to our trend, but we forgot it.
That's beautiful. I think that's true. You have a 21-day program. I'm sorry, I think it should have been an 18-day program, just to be more Jewish.
By the way, yes. I didn't think about that.
No, obviously. Tell us a little bit about how that developed, why you decided that, you know, 3 weeks was the right formula, and how that all integrates to create an effective lifestyle change.
Yes, it was an intentional thing on my part, yep. But they typically say that around 21 days is usually when a habit, when something new can become more habitual. So you got to give yourself a fair shot at trying something before you kind of say, oh, no, this is not for me. It's not really, honestly, according to research, it's not a rule of thumb to say, okay, everyone for 21 days, that's when it hits you. Some people it's shorter, some people it's longer. So next book, it probably could be 18 days because, you know, it's not really that hard, fast stop at 21 days. But generally speaking, because I have my private practice, Beth Warren Nutrition, which is where we've tested the strategy for years. We've been in practice for 9 years. We tested the specific plan with the recipes in the book for about 4 years, and you'll see the testimonials in the book as well. We found that that was just adequate time for people to get to the point where I felt that they could make those decisions and say, oh, this works for me. I like this. I don't like this. The purpose of the 21 days, like I was saying, is to really reset and fresh your whole palate without the obstacles of what would normally come against what you want to have. So, for example, like, I don't advise having artificial sweeteners. It's not just about a health thing and, you know, things like that, because it's not a real food or a whole food. It's also because of the fact that they're hundreds of times sweeter than sugar. So if you're having an artificial sweetener, you can't make the judgment call that you don't like to eat a salad. Your whole palate and taste buds are off. And my whole thing is about keeping it real. And if you can't honestly say, you can't honestly make that decision at that time. So I need to be sure that you're kind of in the mode where you can make the decisions. Ultimately, it is about you, and I want people to know that it is up to them with their decision of what they choose to like and not like, but the 21 days are meant to give it a fair shot to trust themselves and to trust me that they do or they do not like something.
I'm sorry. I thought it was all about me. I just missed the... this process of transformation, of change, you know, it just seems very Jewish to me. Of course, I'm a rabbi. I think about it that way, but that's really what, you know, a process of saying blessings. So 21 days is when we begin to inculcate these habits. But obviously 21 days isn't the whole ball game. It's just the start. So
the beauty of the maintenance chapter in the book, which I think is going to surprise a lot of people, you see what quote-unquote diet plan, and then they have either they do or they don't have a maintenance, and then they're telling you again what to do in the maintenance. And my whole point of the maintenance is you tell me what you're going to do. What did you learn from this and about yourself and what you need that you want to carry on through this in order to maintain it, either to keep losing if that's what they need to do, or to maintain whatever results they had. I obviously give suggestions on what that could mean, like certain things that are very structured about how I'm telling people to rotate their foods with carbohydrate. I kind of say, well, in maintenance, you could be a little flexible. You know, you don't want to have this carbohydrate then, so okay. One thing also pretty unique to my plan is having it on the 21 days even, I tell people to have a treat a week. You know, that's actually a Talmudic foundation there that I didn't even know. I was just seeing that it worked, and it was for clients, and they were to at least a few clients have told me, like, you know, that's in the Talmud. I'm like, what are you talking about? So supposedly, you want to hear the story?
I do, very much.
Okay, because it's very interesting.
Then I'm going to look it up in the Talmud, so yeah, this is great.
Well, the quotes are actually in the book. So throughout the book, I have all, like, interesting little, like, Talmudic quotes.
You do. They're kind of interlarded. That's a bad word to use, but they are interspersed throughout the book.
Yeah, so it's cute how I, like, tie it all into that. But it was with the story of the Pas Basala, about having always having a bread in one's basket. And it was during Yom Kippur that the Kohanim had to travel with the goat, you know, through the desert. And that's just the background story. But they were all fearful. I don't know if Kohanim or Levim, one of them. But they were all fearful of the fact that since it's a fast day,
that is, for those who don't know, the high priest or the regular priest, right?
Yeah, so it's they would have to travel through the desert. And they were worried because on Yom Kippur, it's a fast day. And they can't eat or drink. So they were like, how are we going to make it through the desert with no food and drink?
Oh, yeah.
And God said, don't worry. At every stop, there will be bread and water. And it happens to be that the moral of the story is never not once did anybody take the bread and the water. And then there was a fabulous quote that I'm actually pulling up the book now because I wanted you to hear the actual quote. But it says, the craving of him who lacks the opportunity to gratify it is much more intense than the craving of him who has such opportunity. Which sounds very deep, but the point of that is that the more something, like the more you can't have something, the more tempting it is. And I just thought that was, like, beautiful that clients have told me that with the fact that, oh, well, you're making something allowed. Either I choose not to have it, or I take it a step further and say, even if you did have it, it became a much more mindful decision, and you're therefore able to carry into the next week and all this stuff. So that's what I mean by the 21 days being a learning process. It's to learn to trust yourself around having a cookie or a piece of cake. You know, that's the whole goal of maintenance and keeping healthy, is learning how to have treats and not feeling like, oh, I'm off a diet.
Is there a bracha to say when you exercise, when you work out?
By the way, yes, because someone told me that once, but I don't remember what it is. A client actually told me that. She says she whispers, even if it's a...
Not please God get me through this time on the elliptical, but...
They actually, you know, I don't know if it was so much as a blessing as it was as a pasuk or a you know, piece of scripture.
Okay. Right, a quotation from Torah or from somewhere.
Yeah, they did. And I think it had to do with the Ushmartem and Nashachem, the guard your
right.
soul.
Protect your soul, guard your soul.
Oh, you know what I think it was? I'll tell you.
Okay.
A lot of times when you're about to do a mitzvah or a commandment, you kind of set an intention that what I'm doing right now is to get closer to God or to do... you know, for the purpose of a mitzvah or commandment. The fact that you set that intention and you say it out loud makes it even more impactful. So she told me that before her exercise, that what she's doing right now is something, like, amazing for, you know, her goal is to get closer to God. But when you take it outside of yourself and make it into something more than you just, oh, my God, I'm going through torture for an hour,
right.
It's, suddenly you're able to overcome it, and that's the whole beauty of the process.
You note that it's also for people who aren't Jewish, who don't keep kosher. Tell us what's the best way for them to enter into this, to begin to relate to it?
Right. So I have, in my private practice, Beth Warren Nutrition, we deal with all types of faiths, cultures. We see all kinds of people. And they all can learn something about the lifestyle and the message behind everything, about the fact that stopping a moment and looking at your food, even if they set some sort of intention on their own. It doesn't have to be the blessings we make, but it's an appreciation for the farmers or for who cooked your food or something that just makes you think more beyond than what's actually in front of you. Because the whole experience, it becomes more of an eating experience as opposed to just forcing things in your mouth. And that applies to anything, even with the fitness that I support throughout the book. And I give links, like YouTube links of things, diagrams that people could follow even on their own. I try to really simplify it. But even if it's taking a moment to say, like in yoga, you know, I'm a big yoga fan, and even there we set an intention where, what do you want to get out of this class? You know, what do you want to work on here? What can we take a breath to think about? And, you know, all that is really helpful for anybody. And I think that the fact that I bring in my kosher life and my kosher experience is just drawing off of my own personal experience within how I found the way, but that they could find that way too.
Tell us briefly about your own Jewish background, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in New Jersey. I'm actually I call it a mixed breed. So my father is Sephardic. His family originates from Syria, and my mother is Ashkenaz. So I have the European line in me too. And also on my father's side, his mother actually was also Ashkenaz, and his father was Syrian. And then I happen to marry someone whose father is Ashkenaz, and his mother is Moroccan. So I have a lot of different cultures.
You're pan-Judaic.
Yeah, which I think gives me that broader perspective on things, and why I'm just so confident with this is because I see so many cultures and so many different ways, and I really think we all have this common thread of like appreciation of food and mindfulness and, you know, things that we could all understand and get something out of and all be like, oh, hey, you know, we kind of do that in this way. So, you know, I could see what you're saying with that. You know, I work with Italians, I work with Muslim even, and we all have similar, you know, things going on. But even people of no faith, like I said, they could really just draw from an appreciation of, you know, how this food even came to be here. There's really something that people can learn from all that stuff. So my cooking and the recipes you'll see in the book are very simple and whole foods oriented, but I think it does draw from a lot of the spices and the seasonings I'm used to in all the different ethnic background fields. A very like Middle Eastern spiced would be my thing, but I actually give suggestions in the book because I personally, because of that palate, love very lemon oriented things and things like the cumin and the za'atar spice from, you know, the Middle Eastern spice. So I give like a little bit of a warning that if people don't like so spicy yet, that, you know, they could be add less, but I think you'd see a lot of that spice and that influence in the book with the recipes.
I want to thank Beth Warren for a great visit. The book is called Secrets of a Kosher Girl, a 21-day nourishing plan to lose weight and feel great even if you're not Jewish. And where can people go to find out more about you?
Well, I have a website, BethWarrenNutrition.com, and you can follow me on social media. My Instagram handle is Beth_Warren, where I post a lot of fun foods that I make and some motivational posts, so they can follow me there as well.
Thanks so much, Beth. When we come back in a moment, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Eric Lindberg and Donnie Zasloff of Nefesh Mountain, Jewish bluegrass recording artists. Wonderful music. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website, our Top 10 in America podcast. Our playout this morning comes from the newly crowned Tony Award-winning best musical, The Band's Visit, the song The Beat of Your Heart. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
She was in a white dress with red and purple ribbons in her hair. She was dancing with somebody, but in love and music, all is fair. We were finishing The Girl from Ipanema, going into summertime. I was in the middle of my solo when her eyes met mine. Love starts on a downbeat. Love starts when the music starts. Love starts when the tune is sweet and you lift your feet to the beat of your heart. Love makes a rhythm. Love dances in a dancer's shoes.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.